Welcome to Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. I'm your host for today, Sally DeBoer. Our guest today is Mr. Brian McGrath. As one of our nation's foremost experts on the role of American sea power, Mr. McGrath has testified on the importance of a robust naval force before the House and Senate Armed Services Committee. The founding managing director of the Ferry Bridge Group, Mr. McGrath currently serves as the deputy director for the Center for American Sea Power at the Hudson Institute. Mr. McGrath is a former command-served surface warfare officer. He is currently conducting an American Sea Power speaking tour, spreading the narrative of sea power's import and role in our world to diverse audiences across the Maryland and DC area. Members who are interested in attending one of Mr. McGrath's talks can find his upcoming dates linked on the post for this podcast. Before we get right to the interview, here's a quick message about SimSec.
SimSec brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. And, like the United States, SimSec is, and always will be, free. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership. Which gets you daily emails of our articles and a WordPress account that sends your own writings directly to our editorial staff. No matter how you choose to support us, we are incredibly grateful. Remember, Sea Control is more than just a podcast, and SimSec is more than just a website. We are a vibrant community built on a passion for discovery and discussion. Join us today.
Welcome to another episode of Sea Control. I'm your host for today, Sally DeBoer. On today's show, we're talking fleet design and more with one of America's foremost sea power experts, Mr. Brian McGrath. In the tradition of Sea Control, Mr. McGrath, we'll go ahead and have you introduce yourself and tell us a little about who you are and what you do.
Oh, I am a 51-year-old former naval officer. I commanded a destroyer, and I wrote a little strategy when I was on active duty. And since that time, though, I've been mostly devoting a good bit of my personal time and a lot of my professional life to arguing for a bigger Navy, and it seems how I spend most of my time these days.
Great. And also joining us today is Mike. Mike, do you want to tell a little bit about yourself as well?
Yeah, my name's Mike. I did my undergraduate work at a small school in Maryland. I did my postgraduate work in military history at Norwich University. My undergraduate and master's theses were both on naval topics with respect to Iran, and I'm currently working on topics to increase fleet lethality with present platforms and systems.
All right. Well, let's not waste any time and go ahead and get started. The first topic we want to address with you, Mr. McGrath, is fleet design. So something that's been a popular topic on SimSec and Steve Wills, to our listeners, if you haven't gotten a chance to read his article, I would definitely recommend you do so, about the forthcoming Trump administration having, as part of its campaign promise, vowed to increase military spending and establish that 350-ship Navy. Due to sequestration and decreased funding platforms in general over the past decade or so, as well as the Reagan-era platforms reaching the end of their service life, it seems like maybe we're kind of coming from behind. So I wanted you to speak to, really briefly, Mr. McGrath, where money should be directed in terms of rebuilding the fleet so that it will have the most and most immediate impact in the smallest span of time.
So with respect to the 350-ship Navy, I think the thing to keep in mind is that they have wisely, the Trump folks have wisely not made any kind of a suggestion about when they would want to reach 350 ships. And I've done a lot of work in the last couple of years looking at how the industrial base could flex to meet a larger Navy, and it seems to me that getting to something like 350 would be beyond anything but an emergency shipbuilding plan in a two-term administration. So I think what they ought to do is concentrate on getting us on a path towards 350, articulating what that 350 ships looks like, and creating a sense of trust in the Congress that the Navy can build ships cheaply and efficiently again. One way to get started on this, and obviously Steve Wills is one of the most articulate defenders of the LCS. One way is to build more LCSs relatively quickly. I've written an article about this that's on the Hudson Institute Center for American Sea Power website, where I recommended building two ships per yard in 17, two ships per yard in 18, and then moving to the frigate design, conducting the competition and having the winning yard build the frigate starting in 19, and have the losing yard continue to build LCSs through 25. And these would be the LCS plus that the Navy's going to bid in 17 that has a surface-to-surface missile and a little bit better air search radar, from what I can tell. So this would be one way to juice an additional, I don't know, 12 or 15 small service combatants into the mix between now and 25. What that does is it keeps those two shipyards in business. I think industrial-based concerns are important. I listened to a hearing on LCS yesterday where people were sort of making fun or dismissing industrial-based concerns. I think that's strategically inept. We need, you know, if we're going to build a Navy, we're going to maintain the world's finest Navy, we have to have a maritime industrial base. So, plus the fact that Wisconsin, where one of the ships are built, was part of breaking down the blue wall, and Mr. Trump won that state. Alabama, where the other one is built, is the home state of his presumptive attorney general. So I think there are political realities here. The other political reality is Senator McCain and his desire to move away from the LCS as soon as possible. And I think the Navy could go a long way towards meeting Senator McCain's concerns if they articulate within the next year or so what the follow-on frigate is going to be, and that it will acquire in at the latest fiscal year 26. There's a hole in the small service combatant buy plan right now, and for 4 years in the late 20s, we need to fill that hole, and we need to keep building ships in that. So you ask how to get it started. Hot production lines, build LCSs, build more of them. Oilers, we need oilers. Our logistics fleet is far smaller than it should be. Ship to shore connectors, ocean going tugs. There are a bunch of cats and dogs that you can do that you can build quickly, that you can get on budget in 17 to show, hey, we're going forward. We're going to build ships. More important, though, in 17 and 18, even more important than building ships, is plugging the holes in maintenance and modernization of the entire fleet, not just ships, but depot level maintenance on airplanes. We are on the ragged edge of hollowness right now, and if we just decide to start building ships willy-nilly on a base of shifting sands that we haven't addressed the readiness and modernization issues, I think we're making a great mistake. I think we can build ships and do maintenance and modernization and plus up the personnel account so that we can actually move people LCS, and we can actually train people and all the things you need to do. Because if you're going to build the Navy 30% bigger than it is right now, there are going to be a lot of additional costs that come along with that are not bound up in the shipbuilding account.
And speaking to that a little bit, I think you've covered this a little in what you talked about already, but what are the major obstacles you see to that?
To the 350-ship Navy?
Well, to the 350-ship Navy and to sort of building towards a bigger Navy or putting the nation on a road to rebuilding the Navy.
Well, I think the biggest issue is the president-elect made a 350-ship Navy an article of his campaign. He won the election. Navies never grow unless the president is behind them. So the first thing is the president has to stay behind that goal. And if indeed he does, it is likely to happen. It's not guaranteed to happen because, his bankers over on Capitol Hill have to write the checks, and that's the Congress. The one thing that I haven't heard yet, but that I imagine they're hard at work on, is a story to articulate why do we need 350 ships? Where? Why? How will they operate? To what extent? Against whom? Against what threats? I mean, you got to lay this stuff out. The thing that many people don't realize about the 600-ship Navy of the Reagan era is that That number was rattling around for a while in the late 70s, and it was an article of the election in 1980. But it wasn't until they came into office and John Lehman was able to tie the emerging thinking of some really visionary admirals in the Pacific Fleet, which eventually became the maritime strategy, he was able to tie that to the number. You need to have a story. Congress won't just go pouring money into the shipbuilding account until they know what's the plan and why. That's the biggest problem. We don't have that plan or why.
Mike, I know you want to speak next, but I have a burning question if you don't mind, and then you'll go. So I wanted to ask quickly, so speaking of a narrative, and it seems to me, just from where I sit as a non-expert watcher of politics, that the Republican Party has moved towards the idea of non-interventionalism. And in fact, Mr. Trump said yesterday, and I know there's a difference between things said in promotion and things that actually happened, but that there would be a focus on non-interventionalism and on just on defeating ISIS as far as the United States military policy goes. Does that indicate to you anything about his commitment to the Navy or not?
It indicates, I'm not sure I would say to you that the Republican Party has gone in that direction. I would say that the president-elect of the United States and his support base have moved in that direction. But I think there is a tension, a serious tension within the Republican Party. I am one of the other guys. I'm one of the guys who thinks about American exceptionalism and talks about the world is better with more America in it, the road to perdition is paved by trade wars and moving away from a global trade posture. And so the problem or the difficulty that I see in making the case for a 350 ship Navy is in the to do what, answering that question, to do what. If you are going to lean on allies around the world to pick up more of the slack, and if Russia is perhaps not seen as a major threat, then a 308 ship Navy is probably sufficient, the one that's there now. I think in order to rationally justify 350 ship Navy, you have to have a more global internationalist outlook. So there is some tension there, and I think they can thread the needle, but it's going to be hard.
Okay, Mike, I'm sorry I haven't given you word edgewise, so go ahead.
First, I agree with everything you said, sir. The second thing that you didn't bring up, I think is worthwhile, is sort of the decline in particularly submarine, but also surface assets. You mentioned the decline in surface assets, but there's also programmed in a dramatic decrease in submarines, attack submarines throughout the early parts of the 2020s. And there are ways to figure that out. We're talking about, you know, increasing going to two Virginias and one SSBN-X per year, or Ohio replacement Columbia class submarine. But I mean, that's going to have to get done and paid for, or we won't have that capability. And the attack submarine force will decline pretty markedly right about the time as at least the Chinese undersea threat we think is increasing. And then the other thing I would say is that, and I think you touched on this very well, but I mean, right now having dry dock space to maintain the fleet that exists today is just at a sheer premium. If we're going to talk about, and like I said, I totally agree with plussing up the fleet, but there's going to have to be an increase in fleet infrastructure and shipyard capacity for maintaining that fleet and maintaining the fleet as it exists today.
Yeah, I mean, this is a national strategic issue. It's industrial base. I mean, the Navy and the U.S. military should defend free markets, but we don't necessarily have to practice them. There are sound military reasons for excess capacity that you would never you would never maintain if you were running a business, right? You don't want stock on the shelves. You want inventory of zero or one, you know, that you just get it out and make the next one. But that's not the military way the military works, and we need excess capacity so you can ramp up and so that you have a workforce that can do what you need to do.
Yeah, and if I might add to that, I think that's absolutely correct, sir. The other thing that I would point out is that, like, we've sort of based on, I think, a series of dubious lessons that we think we've learned from World War II, think that we can build ourselves out of, you know, any deficit that we have at the beginning of a major war. And one, that isn't really the history of the Second World War. Most of the Second World War naval conflict was fought with platforms that existed, you know, at or programs that were being built at the beginning, you know, in December of 1941. The excess shipbuilding capacity that existed in the country at the time is just not the same as it was now. And I'm not saying that we're headed for the Second World War or anything like that, but, you know, I think that, you know, it's at least a worthy intellectual exercise to think about how you would plus that up and recognize that the time that it would take to make a massive change in fleet size, you know, inside of a strategic challenge would just be, you know, is prohibitive at this point with the complexity of ships that are being built.
Yeah, it just ain't gonna happen. I mean, we don't have. In those days, American shipyards were building merchant ships. I mean, there, you know, you could take that commercial capacity and turn it into, there was all kinds of excess industrial capacity that could be cannibalized and turned into shipbuilding, building tanks, building planes, all that sort of thing. It just doesn't exist now.
Yeah, I mean, but it certainly does exist in China.
Yeah, that's actually a great point. We have we're reviewing a book coming up on SimSec by Andrew Erickson at the Naval War College, and he speaks to the Chinese shipbuilding industry and their tremendous excess capacity to build. But double-edged sword, I'll leave you guys to read Mr. Erickson's book because it's excellent. He's the editor. There's several fantastic authors, including our own founder, Scott Cheney Peters,
yeah. And
previous Sea Control guest, Jim Fennell. So pick that one up. We'll move on to the next question. Credit where credit is due. This is from our fantastic editor, Dmitry Filipov. And he wanted to know if you could speak to the CNO's recent reform co-locating the assessment division with the strategy folks in the new N50 office. The reaction to having strategy drive the budget has ranged from interested to very positive. People like the idea of strategy informing budgets. And can you tell us what kinds of substantive changes we can expect from this new arrangement and whether or not you're generally in favor of it?
I mean, who could not be in favor of it, right? I mean, it's like ice cream or air. It's what we've all always wanted in theory, right? We all, every strategist or would-be strategist or amateur strategist wants resources to follow strategy. And I think the CNO is... he's making all the right moves and he's saying all the right things. But resources following strategy is hard. It's really hard. It's hard enough to have resources follow strategy when you are utterly in charge of all of the variables. Like if you were running a company and you could put internal investments where you wanted them to go, and you could enter new markets as you wanted to. And the CNO and the Secretary of the Navy don't have those luxuries. They have to respond to national tasking and to national strategy. And so, I think there is great value in the exercise. I think there is great value in the attempt. I look forward to its success. I might not bet on it if I were a betting man. I'm gonna meet with the N50Z or something like that people next week to talk about some of these things, and maybe my opinion will change. I'm looking forward to it. I do like that some of the folks from N81 are being dragged over there, and that there's going to be a way to at least assign them or have some folks who are in charge of thinking about how the fight will happen and what will be the desired strategic outcomes, pushing them rather than N81 sort of making it up itself, which kind of appears the way it's been done for a good long time.
Yeah, I'm also sort of in the wait and see category. Like, I also think that that no matter how good your intentions are, there's a tendency in large organizations to sort of know the answer going in at some, you know, times, you know, and make people less angry. And so I think it's there's a potential there that we, you know, sort of you know, assign the answer before the answer is given. And you know, if we're told to program to 350 ships, we'll find something to do with them, and rather than you know try to take a top down approach. Which may take longer given our needs, you know, but
Yeah, I think the CNO is doing something I think that's even more intelligent and even more potentially beneficial to the Navy than this N-81, N-50 realignment thing. And that is taking a more architectural look at fleet design. And dividing up or thinking about that architecture through domains rather than platforms, and assigning a honcho to each domain, who then works with the, for want of a better word, with the resource sponsors within that domain to create a program that serves the domain's ends, threats, networking, weapons, sensors, platforms, in a I think a more holistic and integral way, so that you're able to allocate functionality more efficiently in a domain without thinking about, well, we got to have the surface guys get this and the air guys get this and the submarine guys get this. Think about fighting in that domain the most efficient and effective ways, and then allocate functionality in the way that makes the most sense. That I think could truly be revolutionary if it works.
Sounds good. Let's switch gears a little bit. I wanted to have you sort of characterize the fleet's current effort to increase lethality in terms of conflict with proto-peer competitors. And we kind of want to know which are the most worthwhile and which you aren't that enthusiastic about. Specifically, we know that you're an expert on distributed lethality, and we wanted to know if you were able to speak to the command and control construct that would accompany distributed lethality, as well as the kinds of training and experimentation the fleet will have to undergo to implement it.
So I just gave a little chat at the Navy, the OPNAV staff in the Center for Naval Analyses had a big future strategy forum at the Navy Memorial the other day, and I was on a panel that was called Beyond Distributed Lethality, and one of the things that I said was that it was gratifying to think that distributed lethality had become so integrated into thinking that we could now move beyond it. Some of that was tongue-in-cheek, but not all of it. And the subject of my talk was split into two halves. The first was command and control. The second was combat systems, and that's boring, so we won't talk about that. But command and control, I think with respect to distributing lethality in the fleet, things like Maritime Strike Tomahawk, things like SM-6 in the surface mode, things like a over-the-horizon missile for LCS and small surface combatant, things like SEWIP Block 2, SEWIP Block 3. Specifically within the surface Navy, Virginia Payload Module in the submarine force, which I think is the granddaddy of distributed lethality, in my view. Those guys were on that a long time ago, and it really affected my thinking. The Navy is doing a good job of spreading its weapons, and I think that's important. It makes you harder to find, harder to target. You get to attack the other guy from multiple angles. You get to hold more of what he values at risk through more ways. But the command and control of a distributed force is something that bears a lot of thought. And I think the way I look at this, and I talk to leaders in the surface force, and I'm trying to sell this idea to them that there is a continuum, there's a slider, as you would maybe, that describes a peacetime, exquisite network and comms environment. I refer to it as the pre-first shot of the war environment, very much centralized control. Very, very strict ROE, the kind of thing we exist in, so that you don't get some, you know, some dude popping off a shot at the ragged edge of the network, starting a war, right? And that requires a very sophisticated and very and a lot of confidence in the network that you have and in the communications that you have. But for peacetime operations, that's probably the appropriate manner of command and controlling your force, whether it is concentrated or distributed. It doesn't matter. You're still going to want to have, you know, centralized control over weapons employment in that environment. You move that slider through, you know, all the way down to what Admiral Swift refers to as the knife fight in a dark closet, where you've lost a good bit of your satellite communication. You're probably on HF, low probability detection, low probability intercept kinds of comms, radio silence. I mean, I think the knife fight in the dark closet is a good way to think about it. Commanding and controlling those forces is a real challenge, but it is something we have to think about in the bright light of peace while we aren't fighting someone in that kind of environment. We have to be able to maintain as much war fighting capability as we possibly can as you move down that, as that slider moves to the left towards dark and quiet from light and loud. We have to have ways of, we have to have backups. We have aerial layer networks, maybe tactical reseeding of satellites. We make aerostats potentially. And there's all kinds of ways to set up networks and temporary networks, but we have to be putting the money in. We have to be thinking about it. We have to imbue our commanders with a very honed sense of mission command, and that is, go execute your last orders. And when we lose comms, go execute your last orders and use your initiative. Go kill people and wreck things. That's what we pay you to do.
Seem like you have a burning comment there, Mike. Go ahead.
I guess just a couple, and I think you touched on this really well too. But there's sort of two ways you can solve that. The first is by increasing your sensor payload on whatever you think your smallest unit of action is going to be. So, and I think that there's a lot of really inventive ways to do that if we want to look a little farther over the horizon, particularly as we're expecting, because in the knife fight in the dark closet, the potential of mistakes is going to go up. And I would point out that, and in my view, I don't think enough effort is being put into, or at least as yet has been put in, to trying to figure out how we're going to integrate air assets into distributed lethality. And I have a couple of concerns with that, particularly because in a similar place to sort of where we're talking about Straits of Hormuz, the reason that Vincennes shot down that airliner was because she was in a knife fight in a dark closet and she couldn't get her aviation support fast enough. You know, the alert package launched off of Forrestal and they burned to get there, but they couldn't get there in time. And I think that would be such a similar mistake in, you know, modern 24-hour news cycle would be even more crippling and, you know, look more poorly, you know, looking at what the Russians are going through, having potentially shot down an airliner. Yeah, 100% shot down, you know, an airliner as well. You know, I mean, there's a lot of blowback from mistakes like that. And I think that, so I'm a little bit concerned that we're what I would like to see is an increase and a real thought at increasing the sensor payload of those sorts of ships to give them, and I have a couple ideas for doing that, but to give them a better look without national or overhead or highly targetable assets. So
there's a really interesting DARPA program called TERN. It's a medium altitude, long endurance UAV that would take off and land on LCS, future FF, DDG and cruisers. It's a couple hundred pound payload, a couple hundred miles, 14 hours in the air, something like that. I mean, this kind of thing with a number of, it's just a truck, and then is it an EOIR package? Is it a comms relay package? Is it a radar package? You slip the package in, and it goes and does its business. And I think that's one way to get around where you are, what you're talking about. The other thing to think about, though, is if we're in a knife fight, a real knife fight in a dark closet, I should hope that mistakes will be tolerated.
Yeah.
If we're in an environment where, you know, we've lost satellite comms and we're fighting a first world power, I mean, mistakes are going to happen and you've got to minimize them. There's no question about it. But I would hope that there would be some understanding.
I mean, yeah, I would hope so, too.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to call you on that, but I do feel like that's like somewhat of a false equivalency.
I don't think it is. And let me tell you, like, I mean, in the Lusitania sinking by a German U-boat in a war zone, potentially carrying war material, was a huge strategic impact. And so, like, you know, no, I don't think so. And, you know, the idea that the entire rest of the world is going to shut down while we in China just go at it is probably not reality. You know, I mean, so, you know, like, and to say nothing of, you know, like some potential, like, you know, attempt to egg us on to do something. So, you know, I don't think that that's the case at all.
Don't get me wrong. You bring up very good points, and I think your point about the rest of the world is well taken. I mean, if the United States and China get into a scrap, the pressure to end it quickly is going to be immense, mm-hmm. which has, in my view, huge fleet architecture mm-hmm. ramifications, yeah. and that is you damn sure better have what's out there in the fleet sailing around a force that can deny or deter them their aggression,
right.
because if you can't, their aggression becomes more likely because the success becomes higher.
Mm-hmm.
It's a relatively logical train, but I don't know. I think if you're, I'm not trying to say that you know, we would just willy-nilly shoot down airliners.
Sure.
What I'm trying to say is, though, is that there will be mistakes in war. There are going to be incredible mistakes in a war with a first world power in which your command and control is taken away. But I don't know that we necessarily want to use the fear of such a thing to help us architect our force.
I would generally agree with that. I'm just sort of arguing that there would be that, like, the likely one, the likelihoods of mistakes will be less likely, and two, the lethality of your you know basic unit of combat will be higher with at least some set of fast moving fixed wing, you know, available aircraft that can look at targets over the horizon, look at the things coming in.
But keep in mind, one of the reasons distributed lethality has attractiveness is because you don't need carrier air wings, or you would need it less because they are finite. There is a finite supply of them, and they can't be everywhere at once. And this is the thing that I tell my aviator friends: in a first world scrape, that air wing is going to be very, very, very busy.
Yeah.
Not just doing strikes. It's going to be very busy going out and doing ASUW.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be very busy, hopefully someday, doing ASW again.
Yeah.
Certainly doing ISR. So, yeah. I mean, I think the carrier air wing is going to be incredibly busy.
Yeah.
Maybe too busy to provide air cover for a SAG that's out there alone and unafraid.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's probably true and possible. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I wanted to talk about a couple more topics with respect to increasing lethality. We've talked about distributed lethality, but is there anything or any topic or initiative you feel that doesn't get enough attention from fleet leadership that could lead towards increased lethality in terms of conflict with a near-peer competitor?
You know, no. I mean, that's maybe an intellectually stifling. Everybody gets all – it gets their – you know, gets excited about lasers. you know, lasers have been just around the corner for 30 years. And so I think there are applications. They are coming. Don't get me wrong. They're out there today. They're mm-hmm. moving. It's happening, right? But it's not like I think, my God, if we just paid attention, we could move it along. The technology's moving along at about the rate the technology can move along. Railgun? I like railgun as a concept. I like it quite a bit. I think I like railgun as a concept more than any for more than anything in its ASMD role or in an ASMD role. If you could throw a high energy projectile that blows up and creates a lot of FOD in front of a missile coming at you, I think that's a wonderful way to take it out. And it's cheaper than trying to take it out with a missile or maybe some of the other ways. But again, railgun's moving. It's moving down. The technology is moving. Someday we will solve the energy storage problem. It's not, I mean, you look at what DDG 1000 can generate. It's not generating the power that's the issue. It's storing the power and being able not to trip all your generators off by shooting one railgun. So no, I would like to see a high speed, I mean, a supersonic long range anti-ship missile that could be fired from a surface ship, an airplane, or a submarine. I'd like to see that in the inventory. And I'm talking 500 miles or so. But I'm relatively satisfied with the weapons. I'm relatively satisfied with the sensors. What I'm not satisfied with is the networking, the ISR, and the connective tissue among all of the elements of the... We've got good sensors. We've got relatively good weapons. We've got relatively good weapons programs. What we don't have is all the interstitial stuff that helps tie it all together.
Mike, you seem like...
I guess I'm a little... I think we've made some really good progress towards electronics warfare, but I'm not quite sure that we're there yet, and I'm not quite sure we've really thought about what it's going to take in many cases to fight in like a heavy EW environment, both in electronic attack and in, you know, some sort of an electronic defense or being able to, you know, providing the frequency agility that we might need in a very, very in a very, very complex EW environment. And then the second thing I would say is that I agree, and I think that the increase in lethality of surface ship ASW systems over the past 10 years has really, really, really changed a lot of things with the way that you can do ASW. SQ-89 Victor 15 is really, really a change in model for the surface Navy, and it's a very, very impressive system. And I think that
the problem is, and you just this that you very good what you point you brought up is, the surface fleet needs a weapon that can exploit the detection range of the 15.
Yes. Yes.
We need a long range. We need to get something headed out quickly towards that submarine in the fourth or fifth CZ to put it on the defensive. Killing submarines is hard. Mm-hmm. Scaring submarines is easy. Yeah. And that's, you know, Brian Clark's done some great work at CSBA that shows that in World War II, we were much more effective in scaring submarines away than we were at killing them.
Yeah.
Let me talk about electronic warfare for a second. Is that okay?
Of course. Yes, please.
The second half of my discussion at the CNA conference earlier this week was about combat systems. And I made the case that, you know, I didn't command a ship that long ago. It was 2006, 10 years. That ship is still in the fleet, the USS Bulkley. The combat system is essentially the same. The kinetic combat system and the electronic warfare combat system were not the same combat system. They were integrated to some degree, but not fully integrated. We need, at the unit level, to have a combat system, and that combat system provides decision makers with automated battle management aids, strategies for you know that help you to conserve weapons, that tell you the better thing to do here is to jam this missile with this technique rather than shooting it with this missile or this gun. That kind of full integration of hard and soft kill, electronic warfare and kinetics at the unit level is required. But then we have to take it to the next level, which is to then be able to network combat systems in a surface action group so that the surface action group can husband its efforts in the most efficient way. And then that leads you then to the strike group, right? I mean, so each of these, you can get to a point where you have almost a web-based, for want of a better, web-based combat system that degrades gracefully down to the combat system that's in the ship, so that you have end-to-end functionality within the ship, hard kill and soft kill, that can be networked among other units in order to conserve assets. That's the thing we really need to do. We have to make sure we find a way that we're not just going Winchester, you know, on the first salvo. Yeah. We ought to be able to conserve our missiles.
Did you have any more comments, Mike?
No, that was it.
Okay, we're getting towards the end of our time here, but we have a couple more topics to hit. Real quick, we had a fantastic debate on SimSec where two of our members debated the use of the term A2AD. Did you have any thoughts on the CNO's sort of announcement to move away from using that term doctrinally?
I have a couple of thoughts. The first is I have always considered the phrase A2AD to be redundant. Andy Krepinevich is a friend of mine. When he was at CSBA, he pretty much, he and Bob Work sort of popularized that term. Anti-access and area denial, it's the same damn thing. It's sea denial. It's keeping someone from doing what they wish to do in a chunk of the ocean. So I've always thought just the term itself was internally redundant. That said, the CNO, I think, I don't have any problem with what he did. I think it's reasonable from the standpoint of trying to get people off their fainting couches. We've got a whole bunch of people who look in on what the Navy does, who believe that, you know, you look at this cheese wedge of ISR that the Chinese put out into the Pacific Ocean, and it goes out to 1,000 miles and up to 100,000 feet. It's equally dense throughout its volume, and oh my God, it's just a kill zone as soon as you go into it. It's just not the case. It's not the case at all. It's loony to think that. But there is this sense that, oh my God, we're going to have ubiquitous overhead satellites, so the Navy has to get rid of all its ships. It's just ridiculous. So I think what he's trying to do is to by eliminating that term or stop using it, to try to make sure people understand that we have some tricks up our sleeve. We kind of know what we're doing. And we can assume some of this risk and fight.
That makes a lot of
fight
sense.
Fight our way in, fight our way out, stay within the whole nine yards.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think I have mixed feelings about that, like him just ordering the stand down, but I think that his saying that, like, it presents it as a fait accompli rather than an aspirational goal is I think very well taken.
Yeah, let's face it, when you're dealing with, let's say, OTH radar, OTH radar has different characteristics at night and day. No. Sunspot activity comes into play here, weather comes into play, all these sorts of things. So what's really needed, though, is we have to have the ability in real time to be able to heat map adversary ISR. We have to be able to see where the weaknesses are, where the seams are, and that's where you go operate. That's where you go project power from, go do your strike, get the hell out, go to the next one. You know, we can do that. We can do that. We just got to think our way through it.
All right. Well, we're reaching kind of the end of the time for Sea Control today. I am not exaggerating when I say we could probably talk for another hour, and I hope you'll honor us by coming on Sea Control again, because this was really enjoyable for both of us, I think I can say. Real quick, before we sign off here today, I wanted to mention your American Sea Power speaking tour. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what that means and what you're doing?
Yeah, I have been criticizing Navy leadership for many, many, many years for not telling the Navy story, not going out and convincing the American people of the value of investing in their Navy and what the payoff is. What do we get out of it? And so I howled at the moon for a long time. And then I eventually just lit a candle, and that candle is my my speaking tour. And what I've done is I've got about a total of 23 different Rotary clubs around the state of Maryland. I've done probably 12 so far, and I'm just going around, and I go and I sit with, I go and I talk for, you know, 20 minutes, and then answer questions with a bunch of people who don't get the Navy. I mean, I'm going out to the far western edge of Maryland next Thursday, a town called Oakland, Maryland, up near the West Virginia border. And I'm going to talk to probably 30 people about sea power, American sea power. And, you know, it's me being frustrated and having more time on my hands than I probably need to, and trying to do some good.
Well, that's fantastic. If you will send us a link, we'll make sure that we put that on with the podcast so that if any of our listeners happen to be in the locations that you're going to be speaking, they can come out and support you. I want to thank you for your time today. It was a true honor to have you on Sea Control. And any last comments or words before we sign off?
I love what you guys do. Keep it up.
Thank you very much, sir. And thank you to our listeners. Have a great holiday season.